Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, a little bit of Walmart, some Toyota, the price of a gallon of milk, and money in politics. We start a special collaboration with Frontline. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 10th of October. Good to have you here. Walmart had a bit of luck in the markets today, just as shareholders were gathered down in Bentonville, Arkansas, for the company's annual meeting. Shares hit an all-time high up in New York. CEO Mike Duke said the retailer's business is strong and growing. But outside headquarters in Arkansas and at stores across the country, a protest against the world's biggest retailer is growing, too. A small but unprecedented strike by Walmart employees, non-unionized employees, we should say, is spreading. Sally Herships has that story.
The very first thing I wondered when I talked to protester Linda Haluska was whether she was scared of losing her job.
No. I'm not worried about that. I'm not worried about that at all.
Haluska works 40 hours a week, stocking shelves at a Walmart in Glenwood, Illinois. But she's traveled all the way to Bentonville, Arkansas, to protest Walmart's labor practices.
If they feel that they have to fire me because then really that's the reason why, then I need to be out here.
Haluska is part of a protest sponsored by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. The union says there were 200 protesters in Bentonville and more who took part in actions around the country. That's a tiny sliver of Walmart's 1.4 million employees in the U.S. Haluska says for her, pay is one of the big issues. She says the average wage for full-time workers is about $12.50 an hour, but it took her 7 years to earn even that much. Haluska also complained about Walmart cutting workers' hours.
How many hours do they have you working now?
I barely get like 25 hours a week.
Tyrone Robinson is also from the Chicago area. A few months after he took a full-time job with Walmart, the supercenter began laying off employees and hiring temps. Robinson's hours got cut and he couldn't afford his apartment. I asked him if he was on strike and if he was worried about losing his job.
Yes, I'm off today, but I'm not worried about it because I just can't be silent no more.
I asked Walmart for a reaction to the protesters' complaints. A spokesman said pay and benefits at Walmart typically exceed that of competitors. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
You remember Toyota's sticky accelerator pedal problem from a couple of years ago and the ensuing recall of millions of cars? Well, here we go again. A less clearly lethal problem, though. Today, the Japanese carmaker recalled nearly 7.5 million vehicles worldwide because of a sticky power window switch that has been known to cause fires. Not something, I think you'll agree, that's going to get you top reliability and quality ratings at all. Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains how recalls come to be in the first place.
Recalls involving immediate danger may be government mandated. Toyota's is voluntary, and most of those start with reports from the field. Toyota first learned of this problem in 2008.
The automaker starts receiving complaints from customers via dealers, usually, that something's going wrong and we're seeing an inordinate amount of repair work on this particular item.
John O'Dell is senior editor at the Car Guide Edmunds. The next step is to consult with engineers and, of course, the legal department.
They talk with their lawyers. You know, if we don't recall, what's it going to cost us versus if we do?
It costs big money to publicize a recall and pay for repairs, and there's plenty of risk in admitting a screw-up. Art Spinella of CNW Research worries Toyota's long string of recent recalls is harming the brand.
The biggest problem for Toyota is not its legacy buyers, those people who have always bought a Toyota, but folks who are on the fence or have never had a Toyota in the family.
Of course, not fessing up about a problem can be far worse than any recall. Toyota was pummeled for how it handled the dangerous sudden acceleration problem. This time, a company spokesman I talked to kept repeating the phrase above and beyond, referring to Toyota's sweeping recall. Jim Treese is an editor at Automotive News.
A well-handled recall can do wonders on the plus side for an automotive brand.
Toyota's bet is that by coming clean loudly, it can slowly wipe away the greasy stains of past problems. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders would like a do-over. I'd bet we'll have the details when we do the numbers. About 6 months ago, we started a new project. It's a special collaboration with Frontline on PBS that breaks through the noise surrounding one key issue in this election.
The United States Supreme Court.
Unlimited money.
Freedom of speech.
Unions.
Moguls going at each other.
Money and politics.
The special interests and their lobbyists.
Super Bowl!
Love that guy, right? Yes, super PACs. The issue is the fallout from the Supreme Court's decision 2 years ago in a case called Citizens United. The justices ruled that the government's not allowed to limit political spending by corporations and unions, which means this election cycle is being fueled by more money than ever, like in the billions of dollars. So part of the noise, part of the reason this matters, is because of disagreements over how much all that money matters and how it affects the way you and I vote, whether money corrupts the entire political process. Or maybe, as lawyer Jim Bopp suggests, whether more spending equals better informed voters.
So we need more spending.
You think there's not enough information out there in American politics?
Definitely. It's a third of the people of the United States cannot name the vice president of the United States. Majority of the people do not know who their congressman is or who their senators are. So you think that's enough information? No, that's not enough information. They need a lot more information.
Jim Bopp is the guy behind the Citizens United ruling, one of the main characters I met while I was away reporting this story for Frontline this summer. So more money, more information. And that's one side. The side that won the Citizens United ruling, it has to be said. But obviously, part of this is because of the strong opinions that are out there about money in politics, including from some of the people who use that money to do politics. I spent some time in Washington, D.C. for Frontline. Wound up talking to a guy named Rodel Molyneux.
How much is too much? You know, when you've got 15 or 16 people ponying up $2, $3, $4, $5, $10 million at a time, I don't necessarily think that's good for democracy.
Molyneux runs a liberal super PAC. It's called American Bridge 21st Century, which he admits is fed by the money that Citizens United allows. I was all over the place reporting for Frontline this summer. Montana, Colorado, Washington, D.C., Connecticut, Indiana. And we found an honestly amazing story about campaign finance, one that cuts through this. I promise you. We're going to air a radio story every week this month as part of our television collaboration with Frontline. The film is called
Big Sky, Big Money, a Frontline election special. Watch online or on air beginning October 30th.
The music makes it, right? It's about the dark secrets of campaign finance this election season. Mark your calendars, October 30th, me on television. It's going to be a good one. So most of the talk about Citizens United by far has been about how it lets corporations spend what they want on politics. But the ruling also gave unions a big boost, their ground game, door-to-door canvassing in particular. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer spent an evening with some union canvassers in Virginia.
Katie Gregg walks purposefully along a busy road in Loudoun County, Virginia. She's armed with an iPad. On it, a map with dots marking the 100 doors she's supposed to knock on tonight. She's a vote canvasser. And although the Citizens United ruling allows her to stop at any house she wants to, Gregg uses carefully compiled voter lists to find sympathetic ears.
So this is our first house.
Nobody's home. Gregg trudges on. She started canvassing just over a year ago for the nonprofit group Working America, which is affiliated with the AFL-CIO. Gregg figures she's knocked on roughly 10,000 doors in that time and gone through four pairs of shoes. As she raises a hand to knock on her eighth door of the night, she tries to imagine what it would be like if she could only talk to union members.
So this is the first union house that we've knocked on of all those houses. I would not have been able to talk to any of those other people.
Before Citizens United, union canvassers could knock on maybe 1 in 10 doors. For years, unions have relied on canvassers to remind their members to get out and vote. Under Citizens United, they can now broaden their efforts considerably. Unions say their ground troops will now be a much more potent force. And Katie Gregg says they can counteract some of the negative ads run by the super PACs.
A lot of those commercials are 30 seconds long. So even if I spend 2 minutes at a door with someone, that's four times the information that they would have been getting before. And so it sends a really strong message.
Michael Post got the message loud and clear when Greg knocked on his door. He's going to vote for Mitt Romney for president, but he's undecided in Virginia's neck-and-neck Senate race, which Greg is also canvassing for. I asked Post which he liked better, face-to-face discussions like the one he had with Katie Gregg or TV ads.
Probably having somebody come right to the door, because then if I have questions I can ask them, you can't ask the TV.
Katie Gregg gives Post one of her flyers. He says he'll look it over. Then she's off to yet another house. The AFL-CIO says it'll have 400,000 staff and volunteer door knockers spread across the country by Election Day, almost twice as many as in 08. Michael Podhorser is one of the generals commanding the cavalcade of canvassers. He's the AFL's political director. He says the extra boots on the ground helped President Obama build up an early lead in some key states like Ohio.
And part of that is coming from the fact that we can talk to not just union members, but to all blue-collar voters.
So the Citizens United ruling has a silver lining for unions, but
I think it's probably a fairly thin silver lining.
Charlotte Garden teaches labor and constitutional law at Seattle University. She says labor's sliver of silver could be overwhelmed by the heaps of super PAC gold the Citizens United ruling unleashed.
So far, we're seeing corporate donations to candidates at a 15-to-1 advantage over labor's donation to candidates.
Labor is plowing what donations it does get into its ground game. The AFL-CIO has created its own super PAC to fund its canvassing, and it's raised more than $7 million so far. Garden says this election is so close that the unions could help tip the balance with their ground troops if they can target precisely the right undecided voters in the most important swing states. But reaching the undecideds is tricky and will take a lot of shoe leather.
Hi. Hello. My name's Katie. I'm out with Working America. I'm looking for Marco.
Which is why Katie Gregg is getting ready to buy a fifth new pair of shoes as she works up to knocking on her 11,000th door. In Loudoun County, Virginia, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
More stories from our collaboration with Frontline are going to be coming all month. We'll cover the essential ideas of political money and privacy, why secrecy matters so much, a look at data mining and how it's used in campaigns, and what it's like to track a candidate's every move just waiting for that gaffe. They're all going to be online at marketplace.org and on the radio all month. Coming up,
being a stay-at-home parent is a very expensive proposition.
A child care cost-benefit analysis. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street is still down in the dumps. Dow Industrials fell 128 points today, finished at 13,344. The NASDAQ off 13 points, that is 0.4%, wrapped up at 3,051. The S&P 500 lost 8.6%. Landed at 1432. Financial stocks stayed in positive territory. Citigroup added 1.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase up 1%. Goldman Sachs ticked up almost 0.4%. Morgan Stanley almost 0.3%. Bank of America was flat. Alcoa let off corporate earnings season with lower expectations due to slow global growth. Dropped more than 4% today. Caterpillar rolled off nearly 2%. Chevron dropped 4%. Walmart rose almost 1.7% on strong back-to-school sales and plans to add stores. Costco charged up 2% on higher member fees and strong sales. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.68%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Stockholm, the Nobel Prize in Literature is announced. Vice President Joe Biden and Congressman Paul Ryan debate the issues in Danville, Kentucky. And want to sample 2,200 beers? Then you're probably already on your way to Denver for the Great American Beer Festival. Outside alcohol is prohibited, but really, why would you be BYOB? There's 2,200 beers. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and here with an example of how one piece of the economy impacts another, and then another, and another, and then finally, your wallet. Okay, so you remember the drought in the Midwest, which has cut crop yields, which has meant higher feed prices for cows, which has led some farmers to get rid of some cows, which has left us with the smallest dairy herd we've had in decades. Fewer cows, less milk, higher prices, and not just for the dairy you drink either. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro connects the dots.
If I say name the types of milk, you probably think whole, skim, 2%. But if you trade milk or write for people who do, like Mary Keogh Ledman at the Daily Dairy Report, you think about the four classes of milk.
Class one you drink, class two you spoon, yogurt, ice cream. Class three you cut, cheese. Class four, butter and powder, you can store forever.
And if you're a company that makes food with milk, from sour cream to soup to nacho cheese flavor chips, your costs go up along with milk prices. But when depends on the product.
Some of the more aged cheese, like Parmesan, those cheeses were made 9 months ago. It'll be longer to see the price increase.
Customers may not see it at all. Companies look for other things to cut when milk goes up. Starbucks, say, may trim fuel costs or packaging, not charge more for a latte. Or here's a company that relies on dairy, Domino's Pizza.
Cheese is a very important part of the consumer experience. Americans love cheese.
Spokesman Tim McIntyre says cheese is about 40% the cost of a Domino's Pizza. The company uses about 200 million pounds a year, and that's just on pizza. Never mind.
Our stuffed cheesy bread, pasta, which has cheese as well.
Using less cheese is not the answer to rising milk prices, he says.
One of the ways that you offset an increase in any commodity cost is by ensuring that you keep your customers happy.
Sure, you could sprinkle less cheese, but those pennies saved could cost you much more if your customers turn elsewhere. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
One of the great early things about the internet, if you remember, was shopping online. You ordered, whatever it was got delivered, no schlepping, boom, you were done. Then as that e-commerce thing really got competitive, we got faster delivery. And then free delivery, even better. Now, same day delivery. Amazon's already doing it in a couple of places. And today, Walmart piled in. Game on, as Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports.
Amazon's been trying to make same day delivery a part of its regular offering, but it faces a big hurdle. It's an online store, and it doesn't have a physical presence in every state. So while Amazon is ramping up construction of more distribution centers, Walmart, with its 4,000 stores in 50 states, has a head start. Rebecca Lieb is an analyst at the Altimeter Group.
Because the merchandise is being shipped from nearby Walmart stores, Walmart is actually able to fulfill these orders.
Here's how it works. You pay $10, place an order online early in the day, and your stuff is delivered by the afternoon. Right now, Walmart To Go is available in a handful of states. The trial run will last at least through the holidays. Leap says, that's the plan anyway.
The jury is out as to whether or not this was going to resonate with consumers.
In other words, is faster delivery enough to make Amazon customers switch to something new and untested? Sucharita Molpuru is an analyst at Forrester. She points out that Amazon's business model is built on more than just shipping. It's also based on technology.
It is able to offer really favorable prices. They have everything from dynamic pricing algorithms that go out and spider the web.
And other tricks to compete. Molpuru says that even in the internet age, big retailers like Walmart can use their stores to their advantage. She's just not sure that using stores as distribution centers for super fast delivery is a way to do it. I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Parenting is, if nothing else, about sacrifice. Emotional, physical, and financial sacrifice. And with daycare running thousands of dollars a month or more in some parts of the country, a lot of jobs out there don't pay enough to justify having them and having to leave the kids with somebody while you go to work. So today, in our latest installment of Money Matters, our series about the financial decisions we have to make that hit us right in our bottom lines, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein looks at the hidden and not-so-hidden costs of leaving work to stay with your kids.
Here's a peek into J.J. Keith's typical day.
You can go, you have screens all over the place. You can go find the iPad. You have to find something, sweetie.
With her husband at work, Keith spends lots of time trying to keep her two toddlers occupied. The family lives in Los Angeles, where daycare would cost about $20,000 a year. Unaffordable. So, she's home.
This is the normal. Two kids who won't nap and both want something, and it's hard to get anything done.
By anything, she means her work as a freelance writer. It doesn't bring in much money, but it does buy Keith a kind of insurance.
So that when I do re-enter full-time work, I don't have that stink of someone who's been home with the kids for many years and is out of touch with reality.
Financially, that's smart, says Tony Carnevale with the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce.
Being a stay-at-home parent is a very expensive proposition, not because of the cost might be directly or the savings. The real cost is the earnings power you lose.
Carnevale says people with a college degree who drop out of the labor market for, say, 5 years could forgo roughly $1 million over a lifetime of work.
You'll come back into the workforce starting out as if you're somebody with a 2-year community college degree.
Making matters worse, daycare costs keep climbing. A recent report from Child Care Aware of America found it costs more to put a 4-year-old in full-time care than it does to pay college tuition and fees in 19 different states. And that only ratchets up pressure on single parents who must keep working. Helen Blank with the National Women's Law Center says that often forces them to settle for unreliable care.
When child care falls through and a parent can't go to work, we know that many parents don't have the sick leave and their job simply falls apart.
J.J. Keith has cobbled together a fairly dependable plan that lets her get some of her writing done. Keith pays $90 a month to belong to the local YMCA, where she can drop her kids for 2 hours a day while she works on her laptop in another room. But like many parents in her situation, she's just treading water.
I'm not saving for retirement. I'm not investing in the future. We're not moving anywhere financially. We're just getting by month to month.
Keith says she didn't expect a life of luxury, but she also didn't think the high price of childcare would force her to choose between her kids and a full-time job. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
We asked you what you do when childcare costs add up to more than you make. William Cohn wrote us on our Facebook page, and here's what he said. He said, I shifted to the night shift. Daycare for one kid would need me to work 60 hours a week to cover 40 hours of daycare. So the night shift means one of us is around during the day. If you've got your own story, hit us up on our Facebook page. We're on Twitter as well, at Marketplace APM. There is, of course, blame enough to go around for the current state of the economy. High unemployment, sluggish growth. Democrats and Republicans like nothing better than to point fingers at each other. Commentator Robert Reich says we ought to look elsewhere.
Most of us assume that at some point the economy is going to kick into gear, that unemployment will eventually drop below 6%, and that job creation will return to its previous clip of 200,000 a month. But what if we're stuck at a new normal of high unemployment and low job growth? It's possible because technology might just have gotten the best of us. It used to be that new technologies generated lots of new jobs for those displaced from old ones. After farms were mechanized, Americans moved to factories. After manufacturing declined, due in part to technologies that dramatically cut the cost of shipping goods from overseas, we moved into services. But new technologies have been eating away at services, too. Gas station attendants are long gone, and telephone operators and bank tellers aren't far behind. Endangered, too, are office clerks and secretaries, and people providing any expertise or information that can now be digitized into a computer. We still have plenty of jobs in retail sales, education, and healthcare, but these are also among the least efficient parts of our economy, and pressure is building to cut costs. And here again, technology is leading the way. In the next decade, it seems likely that many retail sales workers will be replaced by online sales. We're also about to see a wave of online courses in classrooms, supplanting some teachers. Healthcare has to become more efficient, so patients will carry their own medical files on memory sticks. We'll also have personal health apps, allowing us to self-diagnose, even measuring our own blood pressure and other vital signs. Now, all this is good for us as consumers, but as workers, we're putting ourselves out of business. At this rate, 50 years from now, a tiny machine may satisfy all our needs. Call it the I-everything. The only problem, none of us will be able to afford it because we'll all be unemployed.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Beyond Outrage. Share your thoughts with us, outraged or otherwise. Facebook, Twitter, our website, whatever's good for you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a counterpoint perhaps to our story about same-day service that's all the rage right now. You're going to be seeing fewer FedEx trucks and vans on the road starting soon. The company said today it's going to restructure, park thousands of those vans, in part because there is less demand for their signature if it absolutely positively has to be their overnight kind of service. What there does have to absolutely positively be is profit. FedEx figures this is going to boost its bottom line by almost $2 billion by time all said and done. We are all said and done. That's Marketplace from American Public Media today. The Dow Industrials fell 128 points. That's 1%, 13,344 the number. The NASDAQ off 13 points, 0.4%, 3,051. The S&P 500 down 8 points, 0.6%, 1,432 at the bell. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.